Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about monsters. Monsters that come from our and our ancestors' imaginations. What they tell us about our relationship to nature, our relationship to the other, and even our relationship to ourself. My guest for this is Dr. Natalie Lawrence. Natalie Lawrence is a writer, illustrator, and researcher. She received a PhD in the history and philosophy of science from Cambridge University for her work on early modern exotic monsters, and she is the author of the book that we are going to be in conversation about. It's called Enchanted Creatures, Our Monsters and Their Meaning. Natalie Lawrence, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Lovely to be here. Hi, Mitch.
Let me just begin by asking you about the word monster itself. Where does the word monster come from?
That's a good question. It's actually it's a great jumping off point from understanding how they work. So the word monster comes from two words, monere, which means to warn, which is a Latin word, and monstrare, to demonstrate. So monsters demonstrate and they warn. They kind of reveal hidden things that are otherwise not obvious.
And so did they use the word monster in Latin, or did they have a...
Oh, that's a good question.
It's okay.
I don't think the concept of monster was quite... It wasn't... There were other... I don't actually know what words were used in the classical world. Maybe we can edit that out.
Sorry, that's fine.
Crack out the box. I don't know the answer.
Yeah. No, that's fine. It's okay. Sometimes I'll come up with wild questions here. And like, whoa.
No, that's a good question. I'm embarrassed. I don't know the answer.
How would you define... Let me say that again so I can make a clean edit of this. 3, 2, 1. How do you define what a monster is?
That's incredibly difficult, actually, because if you think across the range of monsters that that we are in the popular imagination or in mythology, for example, you've got creatures that are of every single form, all different types, about as different from each other as anything could be. And yet they are somehow intuitively in the monster group for us. So in some ways, it's better to define monsters by what they do rather than what they are. So the monere and monstrare functions are actually quite a good way of doing this. Monsters are things that they are images of our fears and parts of ourselves that we don't really want to deal with. They are images of things we are scared of things we have tried to differentiate ourselves from. So anything that we want to kind of alienate or represent in a more negative way, we can put into a monstrous body. And this is actually an incredibly valuable function as well. If we didn't have monsters, we'd have to face things that we didn't want to face, and we'd have to have things closer to home than we'd otherwise have them. I mean things like our aggression, for example. It's much easier to project your aggression out into a monstrous body and imagine it as some beast that lives in the woods, like a werewolf or something, than to have your aggression, have to deal with it and face it in yourself. It's much easier to think that it exists out there and it is not part of you. So they've been a really useful tool for us over the course of our history for distancing ourselves from the things we don't like.
Yeah.
And sorry, carry on.
No, please.
From distancing ourselves from the things that we don't like, and for removing parts of our societies, the elements of our culture, etc., that we don't want to admit exist, or we don't want to admit are actually part of ourselves.
Yeah, you write in your introduction, there are signs from the deep that erupt to reveal hidden things about our inner worlds and how we deal with reality if we dare look hard enough.
A friend of mine actually put it quite well. She said that the monsters are the glamorization of fear, which I thought was a really good way of putting it as well. So they are sort of glamorous manifestations of things we are terrified of. But the reason we're terrified of them is because they are stuff we don't want to handle. They're stuff we don't want to face and deal with. So it's not just that the monstrousness of their bodies, the horror of how they look or how kind of dangerous they might physically seem to be, is because of what they represent. So it's like a kind of physical manifestation of psychological terror.
Did you see the film, the recent film, the remake, Nosferatu?
I did. I thought it was brilliant. It really leaned into the full gothic glamour.
It really did.
And
there's just one line. And for other people I've talked to about this film, seems like everyone missed this one line that came from Ellen. And Nosferatu is basically the story of, it is the story of Dracula. The classic film, I think from 1922 or so, the classic silent film's called Nosferatu because they didn't have the rights to Dracula back in that period of time.
Exactly.
In fact, they even had to pull the film, but luckily some people kept it to where it became a classic much later. And so the names changed and Mina under Bram Stoker becomes Ellen, I think, in Nosferatu. Yep. And there's this one line, Nosferatu, and Ellen is played by Johnny Depp's daughter. I should know her full name, but I didn't write it down. And she has this one line in there that says, Nosferatu, the vampire, the monster, is a projection of her own shame. And when she said that, my whole relationship to the film, because up to that point it was beautiful, but I was like, oh yeah, this is just like the 1990 version of, yeah, it's Dracula, I know the story. But when she said that, and I don't think you could actually find that in Bram Stoker's Dracula, but when she actually said that, my whole relationship to even monsters in generally kind of shifted in that moment.
I think that one of the brilliant things about the film was it put in just enough psychological interpretation without dispelling the kind of primary encounter with the monster. So Eggers did a brilliant job of giving you just that little bit of modern psychoanalytic nuance without over-explaining or without, you know, shining too much sunlight on it and kind of ruining the magic of the monster. So it was an excellent balance, I thought. But vampires in general are fantastic because they are at the core, they're incredibly evocative for almost everybody because they touch on some deep primal psychological mechanisms. The kind of the base of the vampire is you could take it in Freudian terms and put it right back to kind of sort of deep primal sadism from a very young age. But they can also be used for commentary in all sorts of ways. They can be used for commentary about xenophobic commentary. They can be used to disparage the upper classes. They can be used as fear of the past and, you know, a kind of gothic horror of the past. They can be twisted in so many different ways. I mean, you've even got Deep South vampires, right, in True Blood and that kind of thing. So they kind of take this universal human psychological perversion but can be formed to play it out in all sorts of different scenarios.
Yeah.
So I thought that it was, and to remake a film like that as well, and to bring it with that kind of power, I thought it was quite an achievement.
Yeah, that monsters are projections, and you're also right, but the most potent monsters are created from things in ourselves that we don't like: aggression, cruelty, fear, grief, anxiety, elements of human nature and experience which we disown or shy away from. Our imaginations package up these aspects into fantastical, horrible beings that can be banished far away or comfortingly slain by heroes and gods. An even more cunning trick is to label them as other and also imaginary. They're not us, and they never were real in the first place.
And there's been something that interesting that's happened over time with monsters, in that they used to be things that were banished far away into woods, into exotic places. They didn't exist in here. Or they were kind of excised, like you had scapegoats, like werewolf trials, witch trials. You know, we can kill them and get rid of these, the things that we've projected into them. And in modern times, especially post the World Wars, post psychoanalytic theory, monsters have really shifted to become creatures just like us, or they are humans as well, but monstrous humans. You can see this in, you know, Hannibal Lecter, for example, or in The Last of Us, the Cordyceps infection. So humans can just erupt to become these horrible Cordyceps zombies with no warning. And I think that's far more terrifying in a way. So it's like we can't really project it out anymore totally. It could be in here with us anywhere, and you can't really tell the difference. So in some ways, having monsters not just looking like monstrous beasts or monstrous creatures in an obvious kind of way is far more scary. But even with that kind of psychological awareness, the awareness that monstrousness is actually something that we project out from ourselves, I still think that it's a very fundamental human activity, making monsters. We find it very difficult not to vilify or monster make, you know, political figures or different people, groups with different opinions, or, you know, there's a lot of racial tension, etc. People still find it very difficult not to make monsters of those they see as dangerous or different.
Do you think it's natural to make not monsters?
It's natural. Yeah, I think it's a fundamental human activity. I think it's a irresistible urge, or it takes a hell of a lot of overcoming not to do that, because it's so, you know, it goes right through our evolutionary history. Knowing who is, you know, safe or not requires differentiating groups. And if you do that, you create boundaries between you and other individuals. And it is a natural tendency to see those who are not on your team as more dangerous, and to possibly exaggerate the threat, because a false positive is much more worse, a false negative is far worse than a false positive. So it's always better to perceive more danger than there actually is.
That's what kept our ancestors alive.
Yeah. See a predator, even if there isn't one. If there's the slightest sign there is a predator. And I think that follows through to some degree with projection. You want to, you alienate from groups that may be dangerous because you, it, just in case it, you know, it makes you act more cautiously. And so I think we have this slight paranoia tendency to do this, but it also means that we can cleanse ourselves of the things that we don't like. It means we can get rid of the difficult things in ourselves that we don't want to have to admit to. And it feels much better to think I'm the good one and they're the bad one. So to split the good and the goodness and the badness between us and them, it feels really good to do that. And you see that playing out in public discourse all the time. You see that in all, you know, just look at the culture wars that have been going on over the past 20 years. It's only been getting more extreme, and each side gets more extreme and assumes it's more right than the other, and things get further and further apart, and you get, you know, the most horrendous clashes. So it's a very natural phenomenon, but it's also a very damaging one, and it can be very dangerous.
To fear what's different.
Yeah. To fear what's different, but also to project negative things out as well. To project the parts of yourself you don't want to deal with, your sadism, your envy, your sort of nastier urges, to project them out onto other groups and then assume that they are evil feels good. And but it also means that you get widening rifts between opposing sides. And so things tend to go downhill when that happens.
In the process of monster making, so we can project our own fears onto others, we can project our own fears generally of what we don't like, mm-hmm. ourselves as well. But there's also an element of projecting fear and creating monsters on what's different, in the sense of what just looks different. And of course, that would include people from different parts of the planet, but it would also mm-hmm. include people who perhaps were born with disabilities and have mm-hmm. some kind of disfigurement.
Mm-hmm. That's been going on. Well, actually, it has been quite cultural, because if you look at, for example, who shamans were from archaeological evidence or paleontological evidence, the people who look different weren't always seen as lesser. Sometimes they were seen as more. So you've got all these elaborate burials of people who had clearly had some kind of disfigurement. There was a wonderful burial in Germany of a woman who had all these beautiful bone arrays and was clearly quite a revered individual. And by looking at the base of her spine, they could see that she had some kind of impingement, which would have made her eyes, would have sort of given her astigmatism or may have caused seizures as well. So she would have been a bit different, but she was clearly a revered individual, and she may have been a shaman figure as well. So it's not necessarily the case that we've always seen people with disfigurements or disabilities as lesser. Sometimes we have seen quite the opposite. They could be the focal point of a culture or a group of people. But then you'd go to the Renaissance, for example, and people were fascinated by those who had disfigurements or disabilities. They explicitly wrote about them as monsters, and they paraded them around. And then you had the freak shows of sort of 19th century freak shows, and these poor people had terrible lives as a result of it. But people were just fascinated by it. They wanted to understand why it had happened, but they also just wanted to gawp as well. And there is something inherent about the sensory shock of seeing something different, right? If something doesn't confounds your expectations, it's hard not to be interested in it. It's hard not to find it kind of interesting to look at. So there's that kind of very basic mechanism going on. But there is also the fact that if someone looks different, it's easier to make them into a monster in your mind and project things onto them that you wouldn't otherwise do. I mean, people do this in the opposite direction with beautiful people. Beautiful people get more positive projections. They do, you know, they find it easier to get jobs. And there are various studies of all the advantages that you get if you're especially beautiful. So it is quite hard to overcome these mechanisms. It's quite hard to change human nature and stop us doing these things. And there's been a lot of efforts to try and recorrect this. But I think in some ways they've denied the reality that this is something that humans fundamentally do, and try to just erase it, whereas actually you need to think about it a bit more, and you need to understand it and really understand what's going on.
You can work with it. You can get past it. You mm-hmm. don't have to be held hostage to it, but it's there. It's yeah. a reality of the human psyche that, if you really think about it, explains a lot of conflict.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And it, you know, you can imagine you've got to know, to some degree, being a little suspicious of other groups is a very evolutionarily sensible thing to do. You've got to know who you're in a social contract with, who is going to reciprocate if you're kind to them, who's going to behave fairly. And people have unfortunately used proxies such as skin color, cultural signals, etc., as signs as to whether that's the case or not. But those are actually just proxies. Those are actually just symbols that kind of point to what they're really interested in, which is, can we work together? Can we be friends? And if you can dig more deeply into it and think, what is it? What is the actual division here? Then you can be a bit more constructive in how you get past it.
You go back, some 10,000-15,000 years in your study on monsters, and I want to talk about some of the monsters that you write about and begin going, I think, 15,000 years ago. The horned sorcerer. This is a monster that we found in those ancient cave paintings in France. Tell me about the horned sorcerer.
See, he's a wonderful painting, or piece of cave art, parietal art, that was discovered by three brothers around the World Wars. And as a result of the discovery, it was called the Cave of the Trois Fers, the three brothers. And he's one of many, many pieces of cave art in that cave.
These brothers aren't archaeologists, right? They're just...
No, they weren't. No, they were just teenagers, basically.
Yeah.
So they were about like 18, and they just loved exploring, and they had found another cave nearby, Tuk d'Ordoba, which had some clay bison in it, which were absolutely stunning. And then there was World War One, and then they regrouped, and then they found this other cave, and they and their father explored it with a bunch of archaeologists, and they just found the most wonderful paintings there. And very few people have actually visited this cave, so it's not very well known. It's not like Lascaux or Chauvet, which have had many more visitors, although they're shut. I think Lascaux is certainly shut now. And one of these paintings was the this horned half man, half animal, half stag, half man figure. It was about 4 meters up, and it would have been quite difficult to reach him, that spot, to create the image. And he's sort of overlooking this vast rabble of creatures overlaid on one another, like sort of vast, massive beasts, almost like he's the king of them or he rules them. And now these caves would have been really difficult to get into. It wasn't like people were living in the caves. It was almost like a ritual entrance to a womb, or the womb of the world. You know, you're going through this winding dark cave. You had to have basic torches and take all the things you needed to make the images with you. And these were probably sites of ritual worship or shamanic rituals. So the hypothesis is that this shaman, or so this sorcerer, is a shaman, and he is a shaman in the throes of a trance state, or the representation of his kind of transitional state between worlds.
A hallucination.
So it could have been a hallucination. There is plenty of evidence that psychedelics were used in these kinds of situations. But also you can reach trance states in many other ways, with drumming, with fasting. Like the human nervous system is very malleable, and there's lots of ways to reach trance states. And the kind of the light trance states get you all the circles and whirls and dots, which you do often see on caves as well. Then deeper trance states, you start to actually get to more emotive images of humans and monsters and creatures. So deep in the subconscious, you start to see creatures. There's a brilliant book by Jeremy Narby, The Cosmic Serpent. So some trance states on ayahuasca, for example, seeing a giant serpent is a very common thing. So it's possible that the sorcerer is the representation of a shaman leading a trance state, or certainly maybe he was dressed in antlers and skins, could have been actually a representation of how somebody actually looked while they were doing one of these ceremonies. It could have been a representation of the psychic shift, the shift into human animal form, as a way of crossing the boundaries between worlds, the seen and the unseen. But it certainly suggests that this was a central part of our ancestors' lives, and this was part of the way in which they potentially reinforced their communities, they explored their psyches, they dealt with the intense reality of living in the Ice Age landscape. And it also feeds into how we exist today. You know, organized religion, we still love getting together and, you know, having trance parties. People still go and take psychedelics and go to trance parties, don't they? They love being in big groups, watching something all together. So there's something in the human psyche that really loves getting into these altered states in big groups. And it does help us to live in big groups as well, because living all together in groups of over about 150 is not easy. You know, it's actually really quite difficult for us. So if we can find ways of bringing each other, coming together and overcoming our differences and overcoming our frustrations with other people, it helps us to coexist happily.
It's interesting. I actually went to a psychedelic conference here, and it was a serious conference, and it was about how some people use psychedelics as medicine. And one of the analogies I heard, or one of the stories I heard, was to face your monsters, that there are no bad trips, that when you're actually having a bad trip, what you're doing is you're facing your own monsters at that moment.
Very much so. I mean, this touches on going into the labyrinth and meeting the Minotaur, right? There's something about monsters, about distancing your fears with monsters, that makes them kind of grow horns in the dark. It makes them more monstrous. If you try and avoid them, try and bury them, try and repress them, in Freudian terms, then they get worse. Whereas if you can be integrated with the monstrous parts of yourself, if you can connect with them and accept them and make them part of you, they're generally not that bad. You know, they're generally most people are really not that bad. They're certainly not as bad as they imagine they are. So there's something about the psychedelic experience which obviously suppresses the default mode network. It kind of suppresses the superego parts of ourselves that tell us we should be one way or another, and just allows all these bits of our brain to connect in different ways that can make you open to that kind of experience, or make you open to that kind of rethinking of things, and that kind of encounter that can be quite transformational, I think.
There is an animalistic nature to monsters. And when we're projecting monsters, I guess what we're projecting is the animal within ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I think that's been a damn shame. I think actually I think it's a lot of it is a post-Christian or quite a Christian construct. The idea that you've got this lesser animal being, and then the higher kind of soul or separate human or upper echelon, and we need to strive towards godliness and eschew the body and eschew the earthliness. And I think it's done us a lot of damage, because you actually can't separate your soul and your body. Your body is very much part of you, and these two things can't be divided. And it also means that exactly we have treated other animals very badly as a result of that perspective, the sense that we are somehow separate from them, and that a lot of them are beastly and must be destroyed. I mean, you can see that happening with predators all over the world now, when in Europe and in America, where you get a bunch of wolves released, or coyotes or lynxes, and people want to kill them. The urge to kill large predators is really powerful, because there's something, there's been this long held sense that we need to get rid of competition, and we need to get rid of the things that represent kind of beastly violence and beastly danger to us.
Yeah, in the state of the world, we are definitely the monster.
Yeah.
The world,
yeah. Yeah, in that, from that perspective, there's a kind of I've had this sense very fully with my own cats. I've got two Maine Coons called Loki and Thor, and I've had this very strong sense of the fact that they have this goodness to them. They lack malice, there's something uncomplicated about them, which is really quite wonderful. And I think you're hard pressed to find humans like that. But at the same time, I don't think it's helpful to make ourselves into the monsters either, because what we need to do is we need to accept that we're animals, and we need to accept that chimpanzees are pretty nasty. They're pretty nasty, actually. they're not nice, and they can just be willfully cruel just for fun, just like humans can. So it might be that any sort of more complex cognitive functions come with a nice dose of being a bit of an asshole, really, as well. It's kind of hard to avoid. But I think what we need to do is we need to accept that we are animals, and we need to accept our baser functions, accept those unpleasant urges we have, accept our sadism, not to play it out, but in order to be able to harness it and make it less potent less powerful.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Natalie Lawrence. Natalie Lawrence is the author of the book Enchanted Creatures, Our Monsters and Their Meaning. Staying on this theme of monsters and nature and animal nature, I want to ask about the next monster, Grendel. Grendel comes from the epic poem Beowulf. And Beowulf is this fascinating poem that comes from around the 10th, 11th century. You'll correct me if I get any of this wrong. It's the oldest poem we have, complete poem, I think, a complete story we have in English, in Old English, not an English we could read today and understand. But tell me about Beowulf and tell me about Grendel.
So Grendel, I mean, in some ways, the story starts with Grendel rather than Beowulf. Grendel is this potentially, we never quite find out, he's a potentially monstrous being that lives on the edge of society. He kind of lives in the wild, in the wilderness, outside the kingdom of Heorot, which is a sort of a sort of stronghold. It's got this big central wooden hall, and they love to feast every night and make merry. But Grendel breaks in and he kills a lot of people, smashes them against the walls and rips people's arms off, and it's all very destructive. And the people of Heorot are despairing. They don't know what to do. The king, Hrothgar, he doesn't know where to turn. It's amazing that there actually are any people in Heorot left after the number of people that Grendel seems to be killing. But eventually a ship arrives from overseas, and it's Beowulf and some of his crew, and he agrees to kill Grendel and to face him in single combat. So all of the Danes, they feast and they make merry and do a lot of boasting, and then they all go to bed, and Beowulf stays up at night on his own, and he waits for Grendel to come and attack. And Grendel does, with predictable regularity, and Beowulf fights him and rips his arm off. And then Grendel escapes, runs off to die in the woods. He actually runs off to his mother's cave. He's got this rather dark mother figure who lives in the wilds, who doesn't come until then. And Beowulf is lauded for his bravery and rewarded, and everyone thinks he's amazing. And then Grendel's mother comes to attack, and she wants to revenge her son's death. And Beowulf is called upon again to go and kill Grendel's mother, and he has to dive into, she's got this sort of lacustrine vault, this cave which is under a mire, and he has to swim and fight these water monsters and get past that, and then he can access her cave. And he has this dreadful battle with her. She's incredibly powerful, more powerful than her son, and it looks like he's going to be bested, but then he gets this giant sword and he manages to slay her, and then he cuts off Grendel's head and takes it back to Heorot and is lauded as an even greater hero. So you've got this, in this story, you've got this wonderful combination of this hero who is quite a dark figure himself, and Grendel and his mother, who are these kind of, they're called Mirkstaper, they're kind of boundary walkers. They're kind of people on that. Well, they're people or monsters on the edge. We never quite know. They're called the descendants of Cain. So Cain and Abel in the Bible. Cain was the kind of the first, he killed his brother, and it was sort of the first big sin. And after the fall, and
boundary walkers.
Yeah. So they're edge beings, which is, in a way, is another thing that monsters are, which I could have mentioned before, actually, is that monsters are things that cross boundaries. So if you look at almost any monster, it's got a boundary crossing quality to it of some kind. It's like a werewolf is a human wolf. You've got cyborgs that are human machines. And Grendel and his mother are kind of human wild things. They don't really fit in civilization, but they also don't. They also are kind. They have a human quality to them. So they're excluded from civilization. They're excluded from the nice big warm hall with all the filled with firelight and feasting. And so they break their way in, or at least Grendel does. He forces his way in and destroys, because it's something that he is cut out of. He hears the Danes carousing and making merry and having fun, and he wants to smash it all open. Which is also, you see this also in Frankenstein and with Caliban. So Frankenstein, his monster, when he runs off, initially runs off and escapes, he hides in this family's home, and he listens to them telling each other stories and reading to each other and laughing and making jokes and playing beautiful music. And he's entranced by it. And he has these kind of romantic, lofty notions of who he could be and the relationships he could have. And then when they see him, they are terrified by him, because he's obviously a corpse patchwork. And that flips him, and he kills them all because they reject him. And the same thing happens with Caliban as well.
The Tempest. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Shakespeare's Tempest. So the magician Prospero, he arrives and he encounters Caliban. And Caliban says, you know, when you first came to the island, I showed you all of its secrets. I showed you the berries and the waters and how to live here. And this was my magical isle. And then you took it all from me and you made me a slave. And now I want to rape your daughter and kill you. So there is something about the rejection of, you know, there's a lot of different things you could say here about, you know, if you push people to the edge, or you push those you see as different to the edge, you're going to create a backlash. Yeah. That's a kind of practical point. But it's also, there's also something about beings that we see as edge beings are also, we also, by rejecting them, we also have to project our envy and violence onto them as well. So we also see them as worse than they are. So they are kind of manifestations of our own kind of nasty instincts and our own rejection and cruelty, and it kind of validates that exclusion. So Grendel is very much, he really epitomizes the other in a way, and the mechanisms of the other and how the other othering works and the effects that it has, and it's incredibly destructive. There's a really wonderful rewrite, or a really wonderful version of Grendel by John Gardner, who's an amazing author. And he writes Grendel as a very eloquent figure, a bit like Frankenstein's monster. And he's got a complex interior monologue. And he watches the Danes cut down the trees and act in bizarre ways and have their little skirmishes and have fights. And he sees them kind of destroying the landscape. He's almost like a nature guardian. And he does want to be involved in there. He hears the stories that they tell and the music that they play, and he wants to be part of it. He wants to get involved. But when he realizes that he's cut out of that he will never be part of that world, he decides to kind of self-actualize through violence, to self-actualize through being this nihilist, this sort of figure of nihilism and just destruction and terror, and decides to just kill them all. Which is a really good, it was a wonderful interpretation of how divides can work and how envy works, really, as well. But also how, if we distance ourselves from the love of nature as well, nothing much is left as well. You very much want to retain that love of nature and be part of nature as part of being alive.
As I was reading your section on Grendel and Beowulf and about the elements of nature and sort of the struggle between civilization and nature, in my own mind, I started thinking about one of my other favorite monsters in mythology. In fact, the oldest complete story we have, that being Humbaba, the guardian of the forest in the Epic of Gilgamesh. And this is from Mesopotamia, some like 3500 BCE. It's mm-hmm. commonly known as the oldest complete story that we have, the beginning of civilization. It takes place in the kingdom of Ur. And Gilgamesh, the hero, and his closest companion, Enkidu, who also comes from nature but then is civilized, go off to the cedar forest to kill the guardian of the forest, the monster Humbaba, so that they can cut down the cedar trees to build a great door for the palace. And to me, that was always, you know, and we could always argue what was the first civilization. I think that's a debate that's always out there, but it's one of the early civilizations we know of. And to me, it very much was Gilgamesh to me, because it also has the great flood, which is sort of a consequence of all this. Gilgamesh to me and the killing of Humbaba has always been a story about civilization and humans trying to conquer nature. Do you see that with Grendel? And then I was really pleasantly surprised. I shouldn't say surprised, but I didn't know where you were going to go next in your book. But you went right to Humbaba. And I was very excited. I'm like, oh, good. We get to talk about Grendel and Humbaba.
So there's the original Beowulf, I think, was written at a time when they had a very different relationship to nature to what we have now, in that it's nature was something a bit more to be guarded against than something that we had power over.
We've tamed nature, right? We think of it as a nice, peaceful place, but it was not a nice, peaceful place for humans in years past. It was a very dangerous place to be.
No, very much so. So I also comment in the book as well about how what they saw as a wasteland was almost the opposite of what we think of it now, in that it was a place that was to waste, in that it couldn't be used for useful production. And the wilderness or the wasteland was also the place where you got tempted by the devil. So it was almost where the wild gods of ancient times were present, or the wild beings of ancient times, deities, were there to come and tempt you down to the darkness and tempt you away from a good Christian path. So, which is not really what we see now, you know, the romantics, you know, Thoreau, etc. Nature became something, a place for redemption. It became a place to regain your connection to God and to goodness. And I think that's actually the kind of the perspective we have now, because there's this sense that the core of civilization is somehow rotten, and nature is the place that is sort of the Eden that we hark back to. So it's quite hard to get into that mindset of, if you go out into the wilds, you're going to be tempted by the devil, because that's it's totally opposite of how we see things today, because we have destroyed nature to such an extreme degree, and it is so under our control. I mean, it's less under our control than we imagine, actually, but in terms of the effects that we've had on it have been so damaging. The idea of a pure, unspoiled nature is an Eden image in our minds. But certainly, I think Humbaba is from a time when nature was more powerful and was seen as something to be conquered, although it obviously couldn't be conquered. And if you imagine the ancient Mesopotamia, there were all these city-states that existed on these big floodplains, and you had big floodings, seasonal flooding, lots of big rain. You know, the stories from that time are, you know, floods, this big storm god Marduk, the elements were incredibly powerful. And so then you've also got, there's not much woodland around there. So the myths of Humbaba might refer to actual raids on forests. There may be a kind of historical element to that, but that's not the interesting thing.
Just a quick thing. We did a whole special on Gilgamesh a few years ago, a whole reading of it. And we also talked about the history behind it. And I had read, I don't know how true this is or not, that the original story of Gilgamesh was actually a forest in Persia, that by the time Gilgamesh gets written down, it had already been razed. So they had to come up with this other forest, that the cedar forest that was in Lebanon, I think modern day Lebanon.
But it's almost like the history of it is not the important thing. It's like it's the psychological resonance that's important in mythology, not whether it actually happened or not, right? And I think one of the really interesting things about about Humbaba as well is he has these auras, these powerful auras that kind of that are too much to overcome for Gilgamesh and Enkidu, and they have to trick him to overcome him. And so Gilgamesh offers his sisters to, this is in one of the stories of Humbaba, Gilgamesh offers his sisters to Humbaba to mollify him, and says, if you give me your aura, give me one of your auras, I'll give you my sisters as brides. And so Humbaba concedes and gives him his aura, and then that's enough for Gilgamesh to overcome him, because he's given up some of his power. And when Gilgamesh and Enkidu kill Humbaba, they distribute the auras into nature. They distribute them into the rivers and the streams and the trees. And so they kind of dispel the monster into the elements of nature, and to kind of just make it, they normalize him somehow. They deconstruct the monster. But I do also think that the creation of this incredible, powerful monster is also, it's the projection of the aggression, the human aggression in raping and pillaging nature. I think you see this all the time also with whaling stories, or the idea of all these sea monsters. You know, you're going out and harpooning these things and cutting their guts open, and actually they're the ones that are, they're attacking you. That's not exactly the case. So you're going out and raising this forest, and actually, oh, it's a big monster that we had to overcome to do this. So it turns something that is actually quite destructive into a hero tale. So it flips the narrative in a way that's very satisfying and removes all the guilt of the destructive act and makes it into an accomplishment.
Yeah. Humbaba early on in Gilgamesh is seen as this big, bad, ferocious, scary monster. At his death, he's begging. At least the version I read, he's begging for his life.
There's several stories of Humbaba. Yeah, so there's... No, exactly. So he's not... It's a bit like, you know, Caliban the monster versus Caliban the slave or you know, Grendel as well. All these monsters are terrible, can be terrible and scary, or they can also be pitiable as well. Or like Sméagol in Lord of the Rings, you know, he's Sméagol or Gollum. There's this dichotomy to them where there's a kind of the pitiable beast and the terrible, terrible wild monster. And that, I think, characterizes our pretty split attitude towards nature as well. It's either beneath us or is something we have to destroy and overcome, which is not that helpful in terms of how you treat things. Humbaba masks. There's one in the British Library here in London. The British Museum here in London. They also had an atropaic function as well, which is sort of used to ward off evil. So he was also kind of like a spirit that was a talisman for warding off evil. And a similar function is seen in the Gorgoneons, the early representations of kind of Medusa-like figures. They were sort of horrible grinning face that also was a symbol to ward off evil spirits. And there have been suggestions that actually images of Humbaba might have fed into the Gorgoneons as well. So they may be connected. And they're both kind of spirits of nature or monsters of nature in a certain way, Mother Nature and Father Nature.
You mentioned Medusa. I want to ask you about Medusa. And I want to ask you about women and monster making, and I guess maybe Medusa is the most famous of them all. There is this sort of snake woman archetype out there that you find throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. So there's a very, they're very prevalent, they're very powerful, the snake women images. We're talking Medusa, Lamia, Melusine. There's all sorts of snake women hybrids around. And on the first blush of it, they seem quite intuitive. What they mean is quite intuitive. You know, you've got snakes which have always symbolized sort of danger, but also wisdom and healing. And they've got this kind of magical, slightly supernatural quality. And then you've got women who are fecundity, productivity, reproduction, etc. And you put those two together and you get these really potent monsters who are often very alluring. They can be very sexy, especially from one end. But they can also be terribly dangerous close up. So you've got this kind of dual quality. And I would argue that they symbolize both death and life, death and rebirth. And a lot of these sort of snake women figures are not necessarily monstrous, or they haven't always been monstrous. Sometimes they have been goddesses of Mother Nature, goddesses of nature. But it looks like slightly over time, some of these figures got inverted and became monsters instead, and especially with kind of patriarchal shifts in cultural shifts. So instead of having a Mother Nature that is both beautiful and terrible and brings both life and death and the cycle of life and death, you know, like an Ouroboros, a snake eating its own tail, which is pretty terrifying, but also is the reality of life and the reality of nature. Rather than accepting that and submitting to it, I think there has been this instinct in some cultures to take that over, take the power away from the female figure and give it to male gods, for example, and to vilify the female goddess as a monster. So that very much happened with Medusa. She was, you know, she's this maiden who gets raped by Poseidon, and then she has to be killed by this sort of quasi-hero Perseus, and her head is cut off and it's used as a tool by the Olympian gods. Athena puts it on her shield, and the blood from her neck gets taken and given to this male healer, and the blood can bring the dead back to life, and it can deal death as well. So it has the power of life and death in Medusa's blood. So all of her kit is kind of given to the Olympian gods, which is a patriarchal system. And her nature is one of, rather than giving life when she was, when, before she's killed, rather than giving life, she turns men to stone. So she's a kind of chthonic deity that or sort of supernatural being that returns living things back to earth rather than generating life. So it's flipping the mother goddess on her head and making her a creature of death. And that's a great way to flip the script. It's a great way to show just how scared you are of the female capacity to give birth and to generate life, and is to take it away from her entirely and take away all power from the female and give it to the male. And I think you can see this in, I talk about, other ways in which this has happened in various media, but there's a great scene in, what was it called, that film, the film I mentioned? It's gone out of my head. Salma Hayek. Oh dear, sorry, wait a second.
It'll come back. As soon as you start thinking about it.
Exactly. Oh. So From Dusk Till Dawn. So there's this great scene where Salma Hayek, she's playing the dancer in this club called the Titty Twister, and she dances with this snake, and it's incredibly mesmerizing, and you've got this seductive music playing, and she mesmerizes this whole group of men. Every eye in the room is on her. And then suddenly, so she goes from this position of being incredibly powerful and seductive, suddenly it flips, and she and all the other dancers turn into vampires, and then all the men frenziedly like stake them and kill them. Or try to, at least. I think quite a lot of them die. But it just epitomizes this shift from the female seductive power to, oh, it's a monster, we can kill it. And that really epitomizes, I think, a lot of the issues that have happened between the sexes over history, and that the fear of female power, the fear of female reproductive capacity, of sexual allure, and the desire to control it and to take possession of it, and if you can't do that, destroy it, it's been deeply problematic, I think, over human history.
You find this represented in stories about monsters beyond Medusa. I mean, you mentioned this film, but even in myth as well.
Yeah, so it's, you could argue that a lot of the snake women monsters were Mother Nature goddesses before that. There's a real trend, I think, in mythologies of kind of a procession. You get new regimes coming in, or new regimes of deities coming in, and the old ones tend to recede into the background as kind of earth monsters or earth deities. So if you look at like the Titans, for example, in classical mythology, and you've got all this battle with the Olympian gods, that's a kind of new regime taking over from the old one, and then the old ones become these monsters in the background. So I think if you look at a figure like Lamia, for example, she was this beautiful Libyan queen who took the eye of Zeus, caught his attention. Many people caught his attention. And Hera gets jealous, and she turns Lamia into this horrific snake-like figure who could take her eyes out of her sockets, and who goes off into the desert and eats children and murders people. And eats raw flesh. So there's very much this kind of the belittling of female beauty, the belittling of female capacity by making it into a monster that needs to be destroyed. Is, you see it in quite a lot of different monsters, a lot of different snake women.
There is one last monster I want to ask you about. It's a more contemporary monster that you write about, Godzilla. Post World War II Japan, Godzilla comes from, and there's an element of nature to Godzilla too.
Very much so. So, you could see Godzilla as a kind of the modern version of a dragon in some ways. He's this Titan-esque deity, that sort of almost sort of godlike figure that emerges from the center of the earth. The original Godzilla was Ishiro Honda's film in the 1950s, and symbolized the destruction that was wrought on Japan in the wake of the World War, at the end of the World War, the American occupation, all of the nuclear tests, everything that destruction at a level that the ordinary person almost couldn't conceive of. And that was embodied in the massive figure of Godzilla and his vast size. And since then, he has had quite an amazing career, actually. So he's part of a group of monsters called the Kaiju, which are basically, they come from earlier on. They didn't originate with Ishiro Honda's film, but the idea of Kaiju was these strange, terrible beasts, basically. And there were others called Rodan and then Mothra. And so he had a kind of group of compadres. And together they made the longest running film franchise, including the Japanese and the US versions as well. And it's weird because even though you'd think that this kind of dinosaur-like creature couldn't really do that many different things, Godzilla has actually been incredibly flexible over time. He's played a lot of different roles and meant a lot of different things. So he was this bulky representation of the terror of Japan at the time originally, and now I would say he's almost more of a kind of eco-critical sort of figure. He's in one of the recent films, Godzilla King of the Monsters, he battles these evil kaiju, the evil monsters that want to destroy the world and want to destroy all of humanity. And he almost becomes this Christ-like figure. He dies at one point and then gets resurrected, and he wakes up all the good monsters and they all start regenerating the ecosystem. And it's almost like a kind of redemption fantasy for humans. They've got all these big titans like that have emerged like good gods that are going to come and undo all the mess that we've made. So you would think that he was, not very flexible as an image, but actually he can play a lot of different roles.
Really fascinating how our perception of nature has changed as a species that you can trace through storytelling.
Yeah, very much so. Because I don't think we'd dream up a creature like Humbaba now so much. Although actually, I mean, I can't remember the name of the film. There's a film recently about a rogue lion that tries to kill people that gets particularly nasty. Or, we still have films about bad sharks, or, there are still creature monsters or animal monsters around. So it is something that still gets to us on a kind of deep level that from early on in our evolutionary history, I think.
And subhuman monsters still. I mean, I think of sort of the monsters of my childhood, which included Godzilla, though I was born a couple decades after that all came out. But he was prominent in my ethos, my worldview at the time. But so was like figures like Jason Voorhees of Friday the 13th movie series. And of course, he lived in the woods. I think of Freddy from The Nightmare on Elm Street, who lived in our dreams and our deep unconscious. kind of interesting things to think about.
He's kind of brilliant, isn't he? Because that is the nature of monsters. You can't escape them and they live in your imagination. So he's an awesome idea.
Natalie Lawrence has been our guest. Natalie Lawrence is the author of the book Enchanted Creatures, Our Monsters and Their Meaning. Natalie Lawrence, I found that fascinating, and I thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That was great. Pleasure.